From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
With more than 500 cases reported and at least 24 deaths thus far in the U.S., a report was presented Monday on progress in the fight against the coronavirus. World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus was joined by WHO's Executive Director for Health Emergencies Program, Dr. Michael Ryan, at a press conference in Geneva. We bring you as much of their presentation as time will allow.
As you know, over the weekend, we crossed 100,000 reported cases of COVID-19 in 100 cases. It's certainly troubling that so many people and countries have been affected so quickly. Now that the virus has a foothold in so many countries, the threat of a pandemic has become very real. But it would be the first pandemic in history that could be controlled. The bottom line is, we're not at the mercy of the virus. The great advantage we have is that the decisions we all make as governments, businesses, communities, families, and individuals can influence the trajectory of this epidemic. We need to remember that with decisive early action, we can slow down the virus and prevent infections. Among those who are infected, most will recover. Of the 80,000 reported cases in China, more than 70% have recovered and have been discharged. It's also important to remember that looking only at the total number of reported cases and the total number of countries doesn't tell the full story, except the potential the virus has. Of all the cases reported globally so far, 93% are from just four countries. This is an even epidemic at the global level. Different countries are in different scenarios, requiring a tailored response. It's not about containment or mitigation, which is a false dichotomy. It is about both containment and mitigation. All countries must take a comprehensive, blended strategy for controlling their epidemics and pushing this deadly virus back. Countries that continue finding and testing cases and tracing their contacts not only protect their own people, they can also affect what happens in other countries and globally. WHO has consolidated our guidance for countries in four categories: those with no cases, those with sporadic cases, those with clusters, and those with community transmission. For all countries, the aim is the same: stop transmission and prevent the spread of the virus. For the first three categories, countries must focus on finding, testing, treating, and isolating individual cases and following their contacts. In areas with community spread, testing every suspected case and tracing their contacts becomes more challenging. Action must be taken to prevent transmission at the community level, to reduce the epidemic to manageable clusters. Depending on their context, countries with community transmission could consider closing schools, canceling mass gatherings, and other measures to reduce exposure. The fundamental elements of the response are the same for all countries: emergency response mechanisms, risk communications and public engagement, case finding and contact tracing, public health measures such as hand hygiene, respiratory etiquette, and social distancing, laboratory testing, treating patients and hospital readiness, infection prevention and control, and an all of society, all of government approach. There are many examples of countries demonstrating that these measures work. China, Italy, Japan, the Republic of Korea, the United States of America, and many others have activated emergency measures. Singapore is a good example of an all-of-government approach. Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong, regular videos are helping to explain the risks and reassure people. The Republic of Korea have increased efforts to identify all cases and contacts, including drive-through temperature testing to widen the net and catch cases that might otherwise be missed. Nigeria, Senegal, and Ethiopia have strengthened surveillance and diagnostic capacity to find cases quickly. Further details on specific actions countries should take in specific contexts are available on WHO's website. WHO is continuing to support countries in all four scenarios. We have shipped supplies of personal protective equipment to 57 countries. We're preparing to ship to a further 28, and we have shipped lab supplies to 120 countries. We're also working with our colleagues across the UN system to support countries to develop their preparedness and response plans according to the 8 pillars. And we have set up a partners platform to match country needs with contributions from donors. As you know, more funds are being made available for the response, and we're very grateful to all countries and partners who have contributed. Just since Friday, Azerbaijan, China, the Republic of Korea, and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia have announced contributions. Almost $300 million has now been pledged to WHO's strategic preparedness and response plan. We're encouraged by these signs of global solidarity, and we continue to call on all countries to take early and aggressive action to protect their people and save lives. For the moment, only a handful of countries have signs of sustained community transmission. Most countries still have sporadic cases or defined clusters. We must all take heart from that. As long as that's the case, those countries have the opportunity to break the chains of transmission, prevent community transmission, and reduce the burden on their health systems. Of the 4 countries with the most cases, China is bringing its epidemic under control, and there is now a decline in new cases being reported from the Republic of Korea. Both these countries demonstrate that it's never too late to turn back the tide on the virus. The rule of the game is never give up. I'll repeat that. the rule of the game is never give up. We're encouraged that Italy is taking aggressive measures to contain its epidemic, and we hope that those measures prove effective in the coming days. Let's hope the antidote to fear. Let hope be the antidote to fear. Let solidarity be the antidote to blame. Let our shared humanity be the antidote to our shared threat. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tedros. So we will start with questions. I will repeat that those who are dialing through mobile phones should type *9, and those who are watching us online should click raise hand. And we will stress one more time that it would be good to have only one question per person. And we will start, as always, with a couple of questions from the room, and then we will go to journalists watching us online. Shoko, please, can you start?
Thank you, Tariq, for taking my question. Dr. Tedros, you just mentioned that the threat of a pandemic has become very real. But when you say pandemic, what according to what criteria you say pandemic? Because I understand there's no criteria for the new novel coronavirus. Thank you.
You're right, there is no accepted definition of pandemic of coronavirus or pandemics of anything, really. I think the principle underlying a pandemic is a principle that in some senses the disease has reached a point where its further spread from country to country cannot be controlled. In other words, that there's I said in the press conference here a number of weeks ago, if this was influenza, we would have called a pandemic ages ago, because we know something inherently about the transmission dynamics of influenza. So it's not an avoidance of the word, but the word is important, because in many situations, the word involves countries moving purely to a mitigation approach. And what we've seen is that moving to a purely mitigation approach is essentially saying the disease will spread uncontrolled, in an uncontrolled fashion. But we've seen other countries, like Singapore, like China, demonstrate real success in turning the disease around. So this controllability versus being controlled or uncontrolled. So from our perspective, and as the Director General has said, we're reaching that point, and when you reach 100 countries, and when you reach 100,000 cases, it is time to step back and think. 2 weeks ago, there was 30 or 40 countries. So now it's 100 countries. And that's not a quantitative measure, but it is a qualitative measure of what direction we're going in. And that's what the Director General is saying. We're very close, because at that point, many more countries may become involved. And at that point, the virus will be everywhere. The contradiction to that is, unlike flu, we can still push this back. We can still significantly slow down this virus. So the word for us is not a problem. The issue is what the reaction to the word will be. Will the reaction to the word be, let's fight, let's push this disease back? Or will the reaction to the word be, let's give up? And it's for me, I'm not worried about the word. I'm more concerned about what the world's reaction will be to that word. Will we use it as a call to action? Will we use it to fight, or will we use that word to give up? And I think that's what the DG has been saying right the way through his speech.
And thank you. As Mike said, whether it's pandemic or not, the game is, the rule of the game is the same. Never give up.
Thank you very much. John, please.
Yes. Yes. Good afternoon. John Zarakostas for France 24 in The Lancet. Director General, you spoke eloquently about solidarity, but can you bring us up to speed how many countries have imposed export controls on personal protective equipment? And if you could give us an update on how many hospitals have infections and how many health personnel are infected. Thank you.
On the export controls, we'll come back to you on that. Clearly, a number of producing countries have imposed restrictions on export of material, protective material, and we're currently tracking that and trying to ensure that essential supplies to WHO obviously are preserved for provision to those third countries that we were describing earlier. We've said consistently since the beginning of this that hoarding, gouging, price manipulation and the requisition of material that doesn't allow that protective equipment to reach those who most need it is something we need to avoid. We can understand that governments have a primary responsibility to their own healthcare workers, but healthcare workers are a global resource. Healthcare workers are a precious resource, and the life of a health worker in one country is certainly as valued as the life of a health worker in another. So we would like to see that word again, solidarity, distribution of whatever the commodity is, on the basis of need, on the basis of benefit. And when we look at that, our most exposed workers in the world right now to this virus are frontline health workers. And anything that blocks them getting the help they need, getting the assistance and protection they need, is not good. So we do call on countries to re-examine their decisions to requisition and try and ensure that essential supplies of PPE are made available to health workers around the world.
So I can touch upon the second part of that question with regards to healthcare worker infections.
Health facilities infected as well.
Health facilities. So as you are well aware, we are one of the big concerns that we've had for any infectious disease, and particularly for respiratory pathogens, is the risk of transmission in healthcare facilities. Worried about there could potentially be amplifying events or super spreading events. We have not seen that be a hallmark of COVID-19. And so what we are doing in all countries is when cases are reported to us, we do follow up to find out if any of those infected individuals are healthcare workers. You are aware of the healthcare worker infections from China that we've heard about. And what is very important for us to understand is where and how healthcare workers became infected. Was it through the treatment of patients? Was it when they were wearing PPE, putting on PPE, taking off PPE? Was the right PPE used, for example? What we've learned from China is that many of the healthcare worker infections, some of them happened early on in the outbreak, when, you know, amongst doctors that hadn't had experience with COVID-19, experience with infectious diseases for that matter, and that decline in healthcare worker infections over time is really shown that healthcare workers can be protected. But every healthcare worker infected is one too many. And it's very important, as Mike talked about with the PPE and making sure that we prioritize the use of PPE for our frontline workers is really critical. But we are following up in every country where there are healthcare worker infections and where there is transmission taking place in a healthcare facility. But the transmission in healthcare facilities and among healthcare workers has not been a major driver of transmission for this particular pathogen. And I think there's a lot more research that needs to be done to really understand why.
Just to be direct in the question, we don't have comprehensive numbers on the number of health facilities globally that have been associated with epidemics. Because obviously, when someone is in a health facility being managed for COVID-19, we don't consider that facility to be affected by COVID, as opposed to a facility that's received a case inadvertently and had an outbreak. So breaking out those numbers is important. And again, one of our frustrations has been that it has been difficult to get comprehensive data from all countries. We understand why countries are under pressure, countries are struggling with getting the right information. But this week we're redesigning the data that we require from countries to ease the burden on them, but also to clarify exactly what data we need. And we certainly, within the aggregate data, we're going to be asking countries for in real time. The number of health workers as a proportion of their overall cases will obviously be a major factor in that, and we will track that more comprehensively going forward. But as I said, it's difficult to build a global picture in real time when you're not receiving real-time data from everybody at all times. And it's something we're going to have to address now, but more importantly, into the future.
Thank you very much, Jamie. And then we will go online. One question, Jamie. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jamie. Dr. Tedros, you mentioned the number of recovered in China. What is it elsewhere? What is the number elsewhere? Do you have any figures for that? And you've oftentimes talked about how you want to reduce panic. Telling people the number of people that have recovered could potentially be one way of helping people not panic. So why are you not saying that more often?
Mm-hmm. I think the difficulty in that is that China and other countries are quite systematic in announcing numbers of patients discharged from hospitals. In other systems, that's not announced systematically, number one. It's not usually a reported number in all countries, so that's just a technical reason. Secondly, you can see in China the number of recovered has accelerated in the last couple of weeks because that number lags even more than the death number. So, for example, many countries in Europe, people haven't had a chance to recover. Remember, it takes anything up to 6 weeks to recover from this disease. So it might be quite misleading to say that in a country that has 500 cases, no one has recovered. Is that a good message either? So it can be a hopeful message. It can also be a disheartening message. So I think we need to look carefully at what recovered means in this case. But we haven't been systematically gathering the recovered numbers other than when countries tell us they're gathering it, and we do. And that's why we report the recovered number from China. But it's a good point in terms of, and I take your point, that as the epidemic goes on, maybe reflecting those numbers more systematically may be very helpful. So we look at that.
Can I just follow up? What is your definition of being recovered or not?
Maria will give you the technical definition, but it's usually, I think, two negative PCR results within 24 hours means you're no longer carrying the virus. Recovered is a different issue because that's a very relative term. People who've suffered very severe illness can take months to recover from the illness. So there's a difference between recovering from the virus infection and your body fully recovering from the impact of what can be a very severe infection. So there is no technical definition for being recovered. At some point in the course of your illness, you will feel recovered, or your doctor will tell you you have recovered. But our definition, I think, is the technical one, right?
Yeah, and it varies by when we get the number of recoveries. It depends on what the country is using as their definition of recovered. So it will be the two negative tests 24 hours apart, but it will also be a clinical recovery where they have no more symptoms, respiratory symptoms. And in China, I believe they're also using a clear CT scan. But I would like to give you that number from China because it's more than 58,600 people who have recovered in China. And the DG has said that's more than 70% of the cases reported to date. That is a very positive number, and I agree, we all agree those numbers should be reported, but it does take some time for people to get to that point. 80% of the people who are infected with this will recover, and that is also an important message. But those that do develop severe disease, we need to make sure that they're cared for, very carefully, and make sure that they're chances of recovery are as high as possible all over the world.
Thank you very much. We will go now online. We will start with the NPR.
Can you please introduce yourself?
Hi, this is Ping Huang from NPR. And along those lines, I want to ask if you could elaborate a little bit on what the term mild to moderate means, because I've heard that it includes pneumonia, but I think that when people hear that 80% of people get mild to moderate disease, it seems like no big deal.
That is a very good point. So we do say that 80% of people, well, based on our information from China, let's stick with our facts here. 80% of the cases reported from China have had a mild or moderate infection, mild or moderate disease. The moderate part of that disease, part of that definition does include pneumonia, a quote-unquote mild version of pneumonia. So there are people that are developing disease, so we don't want to undermine that. But it is important to know that this mild infection starts normally with a fever. Although it may take a couple days to get a fever, you will have some respiratory symptoms, you'll have some aches and pains, you'll have a dry cough. This is what the majority of individuals will have. Some of those individuals will go on to develop a mild form of pneumonia. Some of them will go on to develop a more severe version of pneumonia. They'll require oxygen. Some will require ventilation. Some will require ECMO. And unfortunately, some people will die. But in the mild, moderate category, it does include a mild form of pneumonia for some individuals.
Thank you very much. The question from Bloomberg, because we owe them that from Friday. Corinne Gretler is asking, and I think this is also for Maria, what have you learned about the death rates for the elderly versus other age groups? Can you give any details on the mortality rate for people above 60 or 70 versus people in their 30s and 40s?
So, yes, I can. So we've talked a lot about mortality up here, and we've talked about the difficulties in calculating mortality. But we do know that there are some underlying conditions, some medical conditions that will put people at a higher risk for death. And those include cardiovascular disease. They include chronic respiratory disease. They include cancer. And they include diabetes. I can give you a breakdown of what that is in China. But of course, this depends on the information that we receive. There are a lot of peer-reviewed publications that are coming out right now that do have details of the risk of death based on underlying conditions from a subset of patients. So this is information we're trying to gather to get a more comprehensive picture. What I can tell you from China, and this is not data as of today, but data from earlier, that mortality among people who are over 80 is highest amongst the age group, and the mortality is above 20%. There is higher mortality for people who have underlying conditions. For example, for those with cardiovascular disease, around 13%. For those who have diabetes, around 9%. For those with chronic respiratory disease, around 8%, and for those with cancer, around 7.5%. Now, these numbers, are based on a subset of the total cases that have been reported to date. And it is important that we talk about this quite a lot, and what our goals are to reduce transmission, is to reduce the number of people infected, not only among younger people and healthier people, but among people who have these risk factors, so we can prevent infection in people who have these risk factors. So we hope that we will receive more information about underlying conditions and the risk of death from a number of other countries, but that is some information that we need to see the consistency across countries.
I think those data you presented, Maria, are publicly available data.
Yes,
so this is not a surprise to countries.
Yeah.
And countries making their pandemic plans are well aware of the numbers and estimates in China for many weeks now.
Yes.
And I think it's very important when we make the sometimes brutal calculations of herd immunity and delaying of spread and achieving herd immunity and how maybe we should let the wave pass over us and then more people will be immune and this will all go away, that there are many vulnerable people in our communities for which this still will not go away. Turning to face that fire is very important. Our elderly, our people with underlying conditions, people with cancer on chemotherapy and others are precious members of our society. And the arithmetic of epidemiology, as I said, for me, in epidemiology, we talk about the N, the size of the population we're dealing with. We often say the N is the population of the country or the population of the world. So is N 7.8 billion? But for me, as a medical professional, N equals one. Every person matters. Every single person matters. And every community matters. And every society matters, every country matters. So I think we have to balance what are the epidemiologic calculations with what are the really tragic and difficult scenes of family members worrying about particularly their elderly relatives, or spouses worrying about their partners who have cancer or are on chemotherapy. This is a very personal story, and it's very easy to wrap it up in numbers and graphs and trends. But in the end, there are many, many people around the world who are concerned, and they're particularly concerned about those in their families and communities who are very vulnerable. And it is the duty of us all, governments, communities alike, to do as much as we can to protect those communities, and particularly to protect those vulnerable people amongst us. N equals one.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.